Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's almost spring. Yeah. Nah. We're a month past the shortest day of the year. It's almost summer. Well, hopefully everybody had a good week. There's always just lots going on, so if you take your Bibles and turn over to Genesis chapter 16. A while back I was watching television, and you saw PBS up there. Well, we're going to watch something here in a few minutes. It's interesting how the brain works. Sometimes you see something on TV and that prompts a thought, and then that links to something else, and before you know it, you know, you're off on some journey. And that's exactly what happened here and what prompted this message. And so I want to start off in Genesis chapter 16 and verse 1. And you all know this story, but we'll read it just to get the background of it. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children, but she had an Egyptian maidservant named Hagar. So she said to Abram, "The Lord has kept me from having children. Go sleep with my maidservant. Perhaps I can build a family through her." So surrogate parenthood is no new thing. You know, this was a long time ago. And certainly, Sarai wanted her husband to have heirs, and so she offered him her maidservant. And Abram agreed to what Sarai said. And so after Abram had been living in Canaan 10 years, Sarai, his wife, took her Egyptian maidservant, Hagar, and gave her to her husband to be his wife. He slept with Hagar, and she conceived. When she knew that she was pregnant, she began to despise her mistress. And certainly, if you really think about the situation, that's not surprising. I mean, it's as if, you know, two wives were living in the same household. One could have children, one couldn't. And certainly, one was in a lesser position socially. Maybe she was a slave. That's why she was a maidservant. I don't know. But certainly she was faced with the fact that, you know, she would bear a child. It would end up being somebody else's and inherit somebody else's inheritance. And so when she knew that she was pregnant, she began to despise her mistress. And then Sarai said to Abraham, "You know, you are responsible for this wrong that I'm suffering. I put my servant in your arms, and now that she knows she is pregnant, she despises me. May the Lord judge between you and me." And so she obviously was a little bit confused about, you know, what happened. She put this woman in her husband's arms, and then she's upset with her husband, you know. Your servant is in your hands," Abram said. "Do with her whatever you think best." And then Sarai mistreated Hagar so that she fled from her. And so we get this picture of just all kinds of conflict and anguish and anxiety that is occurring in this relationship, to the point where Hagar finally left. "The angel of the Lord found Hagar near a spring in the desert. It was a spring that is beside the road to Shur. And he said, 'Hagar, servant of Sarai, where have you come from and where are you going?' And Hagar said, 'I'm running away from my mistress, Sarai.' And when the angel of the Lord told her, or then the angel of the Lord told her, 'Go back to your mistress and submit to her.' The angel added, 'I will so increase your descendants that they will be too numerous to count.' And the angel of the Lord also said to her, 'You are now with child, and you will have a son. You shall name him Ishmael, for the Lord has heard your misery. And he will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand against him.' and he will live in hostility toward all of his brothers. Now, it would seem that that would not be great news for someone that was in such a situation. She's in the desert, she's by a spring, she's run away, she has nothing, she's pregnant. And God's servant obviously tells her, you know, you're going to have a son, he's going to be the father of many nations, and he's going to be a donkey of a man and not get along with anybody. But she gave the name, she gave this name to the Lord who spoke to her. She said, "You are the God who sees me." For she said, "I have now seen the one who sees me." And that is why the well was called Beer Lahai Roy. It is there between Kadesh and Bered. And so, because God came to Hagar and explained to her what her future was going to be and what the future of her son was going to be, he obviously recognized the plight that she was in, and she acknowledged the fact that this God, her God, saw her. In other words, he didn't just see where she was, but he saw the situation that she was in. And obviously the implication is, just like any of us, if we see something, we're generally facing it. We're facing it from the point of view that we are looking in that direction and our eyes are focused on that. It's in front of our face, and certainly her situation was such, and you know, we don't know, but she undoubtedly called out to God, that God saw her and that he understood the situation that she was in, and he understood what she needed at the time. Now, this whole idea of being in front of the face is something that shows up throughout the Bible. And it's always kind of intrigued me a little bit as to why that is important. Because we'll read a number of scriptures here where the scripture actually talks about that and why it's important to be in front of the face. Turn over to Genesis chapter 32. And we're going to look at some of these scriptures here quick, just as a little bit more background. This is the story of Jacob wrestling with God. And if you remember the story, Jacob is on his way to visit his brother Esau. Esau had made threats against him. He knew that Esau was undoubtedly going to take revenge for Jacob stealing his birthright. And so when he gets to the river, he sends his family and all of his goods across the river, and he kind of stays behind. And at that point, he ends up having a wrestling match. And in verse 27, Jacob has wrestled to the point where he just simply will not let this man go. And we know that it was God or an angel of God, certainly God's messenger. And he dislocated Jacob's hip. And then the man said in verse 26, "Let me go, for it is daybreak." But Jacob replied, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." And the man asked him, "What is your name?" "Jacob," he answered. And then the man said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with men and have overcome." Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." But he replied, "Why do you ask my name?" And then he blessed them there. And so Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "It is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared." And so at this point now, we see another story of someone having an interaction with God. And as Jacob says here, he saw God face to face. He recognized who this man was that he wrestled with. But we see an added aspect to it that not only was his life spared, but really the prophecy and what this man had told Jacob was that Jacob was saved. Okay? And it was in part related to this incident where he was face to face with God. Turn over to Exodus chapter 33. Exodus 33:11. Or let's back up to verse 7. Now Moses used to take a tent and pitch it outside the camp some distance away, calling it the tent of meeting. Everyone inquiring of the Lord would go to the tent of meeting outside the camp. And whenever Moses went out to the tent, all of the people rose and stood at the entrances to their tents, watching Moses until he entered the tent. As Moses went into the tent, the pillar of the cloud would come down and stay at the entrance while the Lord spoke to Moses. Whenever the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the entrance to the tent, they all stood and worshipped, each at the entrance to his tent. The Lord would speak to Moses face to face, as a man speaks with his friend. Then Moses would return to the camp, but his young aide, Joshua, son of Nun, would not leave the tent. And so here's an example of the people seeing Moses, their physical leader, literally speaking to God face to face, is what the scripture says. Now let's turn over one chapter to chapter 34 and verse 29. This is the story of Moses going up on Mount Sinai to get the tablets. And in verse 29, when Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the two tablets of testimony in his hands, he was not aware that his face was radiant, because he had spoken with the Lord. When Aaron and all of the Israelites saw Moses, his face was radiant, and they were afraid to come near him, because obviously they could see God reflected in his face. But Moses called to them, so Aaron and all of the leaders of the community came back to him, and he spoke to them. Afterward, all of the Israelites came near him, and he gave them all the commands that the Lord had given him on Mount Sinai. When Moses finished speaking to them, he put a veil over his face, but whenever he entered the Lord's presence to speak with him, he removed the veil until he came out. And when he came out and told the Israelites what he had been commanded, they saw that his face was radiant, and then Moses would put the veil back over his face until he went in to speak with the Lord. And so here's an example of Moses, in a sense, speaking to God face to face, and as a result, what is being reflected in Moses' face was the presence of God. Numbers chapter 6. In Numbers, Israel was given the instruction for the priesthood, and all of those instructions had to do with the various ceremonies and things that needed to be done. And in verse 22 of Numbers 6, the Lord said to Moses, "Tell Aaron and his sons, this is how you are to bless the Israelites. Say to them, 'The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace.'" So again, we've got another example of God's face here facing the people. And certainly if we think back on the other incidents, you know, that's when God came to an understanding of Hagar's situation. That's when he was instructing Israel through Moses. That's when he was making the promise to Jacob, was when he was face to face. David picks up this kind of a theme in a number of the Psalms. And I'll just read five or so of these quick. Psalms 4, verse 6. David said, "Many are asking, 'Who can show us any good? Let the light of your face shine upon us, O Lord.'" In Psalm 27 and verse 8, David talks about seeking God's face. He says, "My heart says to you, seek his face. Your face, Lord, I will seek." In chapter 31 and verse 16, it says, "Let your face shine on your servant. Save me in your unfailing love." And here we see this link again with saving or salvation. In Psalm 44 and verse 3, "It was not by their sword that they won the land, nor did their arm bring them victory. It was by your right hand, your arm, and the light of your face, for you loved them." And here we see the face linked to love, and certainly we understand from, you know, various scriptures that we've read that God's love is certainly what brings about salvation. Let's look at one more scripture in Psalms 80 and verse 3. Says, "Restore us, O God, make your face shine upon us, that we may be saved." And so we see this whole idea even expressed by David, kind of making reference back to what occurred earlier in the Old Testament about salvation and love and instruction and understanding coming in part as a result to being face to face. Now, in thinking about all of this and this whole idea of face to face, it struck me a while back when I was watching a PBS special. It was a PBS special about the brain, and some of you may have seen it. And I want to play you a couple of clips, or three clips from it, because it really talks about how our development is really related to, in part, the face. And so I'm going to go back here to the computer and just start this thing, and we're going to watch two or three clips. And I want you to really think about what we read here and some of the things that we were thinking about with respect to God being face-to-face with his people and certainly being face-to-face in giving instruction, in granting salvation, in saving someone from whatever situation that they were in. Take a minute here for the projector to wake up.
Worlds and Ideas. Support your PBS station.
What does a brain need to be healthy? Well, it needs nutrients from the food you eat, needs oxygen from your blood, plenty of water, but there's something else, something equally as important. It needs other people.
Human beings are extremely social creatures. We come together, we team up, we share moments of intense joy and disappointment.
We don't just seek out other people to have a good time. Your brain function depends on the social web that you're in. Your neurons require other people's neurons to thrive and survive.
I want to show you how our brains are fundamentally wired to work together. how this social network that envelops us from birth is vital for our survival.
Yeah, okay.
Understanding how brains deal with each other allows us to understand what bonds our species, driving us to help one another, and what makes us hate, what allows acts of human violence. It helps us to make sense of our past and holds the key to our future.
Now, I want to advance this a little bit, but I want you to think about this. This is certainly related to simply our human brains as a member of this species. But I want you to think about this with respect to the fact that we are a created being, and we are created in the likeness of our Creator. And certainly, this has specific aspects to how we relate to our Father.
These are just shapes on a screen, but we can't help but tell stories about them. Why? It's because our brains are so primed for social interaction that we look for intention and relationships all around us.
One way we navigate the social world is by judging other people's intentions. Is she trying to be helpful? Are we a trustworthy team? Our brains are good at making these sorts of judgments, and we do it constantly. But do we learn this skill from life experience, or are we born with it?
To figure out which one it is, I've invited over some people who don't have much experience with the world. I've invited them to a puppet show.
These babies are all under 12 months old. They're just beginning to explore the world around them. You could say they're all a little short on life experience. We decided to run a simple experiment developed at Yale University. Here's a duck struggling to open a box. One bear helps the duck. The other is mean to the duck.
Okay, Bowie. Here you go. There are two puppets.
When the show's over, I let the babies choose a bear to play with.
Yeah, okay. Is that the one you want? All right.
Almost every one of them chooses the bear that's been kind.
Yeah.
These babies can't walk or talk, and yet they already have the tools to make judgments about others.
Yeah, okay.
It's often assumed that trust is something that we learn from our experience in the world. But these experiments demonstrate that even as babies, we come equipped with social antenna for feeling our way through the world. The brain comes with inborn instincts for figuring out who's trustworthy and who's not.
Now we'll hear a little bit about how those instincts actually worked, and this is where it becomes more relevant to the whole idea of being face to face. Let me give a little bit of a preface here. He had just spent some time talking about a man whose name is John Robison, and John is a person who had been diagnosed with Asperger's, which is a form of autism. And he had very difficult time early in life being able to interact socially with other people because of the symptoms of Asperger's. And so with that as a preface, I want to play this.
Many regions of the brain are engaged during social interaction. But in autism, that brain activity isn't seen as strongly, and that's paralleled by diminished social skills.
I didn't really understand that there were complex messages in faces until I was well into adulthood and learned about autism. I knew that people could display signs of crazed anger. But if you asked about more subtle expressions, you know, I think you're sweet, and I wonder what you're hiding, or I'd really like to do that, or I wish you'd do this or that, I had no idea about things like that.
But then came a transforming moment in John's life. In 2008, he was invited to Harvard Medical School to take part in an experiment on his brain, overseen by Dr. Alvaro Pascal Leon.
It was an attempt to try to understand how activity in one area affects activity in another area, and how that affects behavior.
The experiment was only meant to help the scientists gain greater knowledge about the autistic brain. But then, something unexpected happened. John was given transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS. Magnetic coils were placed next to his head to generate minute electrical currents in the brain and alter its activity. The researchers targeted different regions of John's brain to see whether interfering with his brain activity had any effect on his behavior.
They would test me after the session. I would go home kind of not knowing what to expect.
At first, there was no result. But then they targeted the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, a region involved in flexible thinking and abstraction. And something dramatic happened.
Somehow I became different.
He contacted us very excited to say, you know, the effects of the stimulation seem to have unlocked something, and the effects is still lasting, and I now can do things that I could never do.
After the TMS, I was able to sort of read signals from other people and understand what was going on.
So I listened to it, fascinated by it, and thought, okay, well, whatever, it'll go away. But it didn't. It actually remained something that had really fundamentally changed in him.
Somehow, and entirely accidentally, the TMS had unlocked a whole new world for John.
I'd be tempted to say I couldn't read people and now I can, but that's not really true. Okay, how about a full-size one of them? It's more accurate to say I had no idea there were these messages emanating from other people. TMS showed me those messages. And now that I'm aware that they're out there, everything I do is different. All of a sudden, you can walk around and engage the world. And it's a big, big thing. Okay, thanks.
We don't know exactly what happened neurobiologically, but I think it now offers the opportunity for us to understand what behavioral modifications, what interventions might be possible to learn from him that we can then teach others.
John's transformation is a reminder that all the activities of the human brain, including the subtle interplay of emotions and relationships, are rooted in the detailed patterns of trillions of electrochemical signals. Somehow, humans can look at each other and study the arrangement of facial muscles, and then process that information into an understanding of other people's thoughts and emotions. It's an astonishing skill because the cues are so subtle, and the processing is so rapid that the whole operation runs under your radar. It only takes 33 milliseconds for your brain to process basic information about someone's facial expression and start reacting to it.
So you're going to put one electrode right above your...
So how does it do that?
And the other right on your cheek. Here we go. Great.
I've invited a group of people to run an experiment. I've wired them up to a machine that measures movements in their facial muscles, and I've asked them to look at photographs of faces.
When participants are looking at a photograph with a smile or a frown, we see this activity on the graph, which indicates that their own facial muscles are moving. Why? Well, it turns out that they are automatically mirroring with their own faces the expressions that they're seeing.
That was fun, right? The last
one?
Yeah, it was a fun test.
But what purpose does this mirroring serve? I've invited a second group of people. They're similar to the first group, except for one thing.
This is the most lethal neurotoxin on the planet. If you were to ingest even a fraction of this, your brain could no longer tell your muscles how to contract, and you would die of total paralysis. So it seems unlikely that anyone would pay to have this injected into themselves, but they do. This is known as botulinum toxin, or Botox. If you put it in your forehead muscles, it paralyzes them to reduce wrinkling. But there's a less well-known side effect.
When our participants with Botox went through the same tests, their facial muscles responded less. No surprise there. But replicating an experiment out of Duke University, we had both groups look at facial expressions, and now they were asked to choose the word that best described the emotion they were seeing.
Panic.
Panicked. Upset.
On average, the Botox group was worse at identifying the emotions correctly.
Skeptical?
It seems that the lack of feedback from their facial muscles impairs their ability to read other people. The paralyzed faces of Botox users not only makes it hard for us to tell what they're feeling, those same frozen muscles make it hard for them to read us. And that tells us something.
When I'm happy or sad, part of that feeling relies on the unconscious feedback from muscles in my face. And our social brains take advantage of that. So when we're trying to understand what someone else is feeling, we try on their facial expression.
This automatic mirroring of expressions is just one way in which we understand others. The brain also has a deeper way.
So there's a whole lot going on here. And when I watched this, there were a whole lot of things going through my head that were related to, you know, our Christian experience. Yeah, you can turn it off. And, you know, what we've read and studied in the Bible and our understanding of how God relates to his people and how we relate to God. You know, John Robeson talked about something happened that changed him and he didn't know what it was. Well, that was a conversion in a sense. And certainly there was a new aspect in him that made it possible for him to do things that he never understood before. You know, we read about the veil being placed over Moses' face to hide the radiance that was a reflection of God. And we see, you know, the fact that people who had been treated with Botox, their facial expressions can't mirror the expression of someone that they may be talking to, and as a result, they don't understand those subtle, under-the-radar issues or input from another person. And so their ability to even empathize is affected. If we think back to Hagar and her situation that she was in, and the fact that as a result of her visit from God, she named the place, God sees me. And in a sense, we see a reflection of or an incident where we get a hint of what God's ministry is, that his ministry is one of seeing us in various situations and then intervening, certainly at our request. But we begin to understand when we see something like this, even though it's really just explaining to us the science of our brain about how some of those things interact and how our interaction with God, we would hope, would be face-to-face. Because certainly it's that face-to-face interaction that begins to impart all kinds of things. And as a result then, we mirror in our faces God. Now, that can become part of God's ministry as well. Turn over to Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 13. We read most of this last week, but I want to read it again here in a little bit different light. 1 Corinthians chapter 13, and now I will show you the most excellent way. If I speak with tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and have all knowledge, and if I have faith that can move mountains, but I have not love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and surrender my body to the flames, but have not love, I have nothing. And if you really think about what's going on in here, love is just an expression, an outward expression. All of these other things are not necessarily an outward expression. Having all knowledge is not an outward expression, but certainly love is. If we jump down to verse 8, it says, love never fails, but where there are prophecies, they will cease, and where there are tongues, they will be stilled, and where there is knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part, and when perfection comes, the imperfect disappears. When I was a child, I talked like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. And when I became a man, I put away childish things, I put childish ways behind me. Now we see a poor reflection in a mirror, but then we shall see face to face. Certainly, you know, we think back on Moses and the veil. You know, the people didn't want to see God's reflection shining in his face, and so he put a veil up. But certainly that's what we want to see. We want to be able to see God face to face. Because as we've seen not only in the television special here, but in part as we've read in Psalms and other places, you know, those patriarchs that received promises and received instruction and had a personal relationship with God as a friend did it face to face, and that's what they sought. Now we see a poor reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. And certainly, God knew Hagar, and at some point, she knew him because of that face-to-face interaction. And the same happened with Jacob, and that's what David prayed for. Turn over to 2 Corinthians chapter 3. 2 Corinthians 3 and verse 7. Paul here has been talking about the ministry of the Old Covenant and the ministry of the New Covenant. And he says in verse 7, Now if the ministry that brought death, which was engraved in letters on stone, came with glory, so that the Israelites could not look steadily at the face of Moses because of its glory, fading though it was, will not the ministry of the Spirit be even more glorious? And so here we see this link again, referencing back to Moses, talking about a ministry. And it's the ministry of God, certainly of love, that's reflected in our faces. It was in part reflected in Moses' face, and people didn't want to see it. But certainly if that's a ministry that's reflected in our face, that's an expression of God's love that can be seen by other people. We just saw in the TV special here that we are very social human, you know, animals in that sense. Human beings are very social, and we read these things in each other's faces. And certainly, if we've had a conversion that took place and our mind is open with God's Spirit, then similar to John Robeson, we can begin to read those things in other people, and they can begin to see God's love in our face. And all of that occurs under the radar. It's not an obvious, blatant occurrence. It occurs subtly. Let's jump ahead to verse 12. Paul continues, "Therefore, since we have such a hope, we are very bold. We are not like Moses, who would put a veil over his face to keep the Israelites from gazing at it while the radiance was fading away. But their minds were made dull," is kind of as if it was Botox in a sense, you know, made dull. The face can't react, the mind doesn't get the input. "But their minds were made dull, for to this day the same veil remains when the old covenant is read. It has not been removed, because only in Christ is it taken away. Even to this day, when Moses is read, the veil covers their hearts. But whenever anyone turns to the Lord, the veil is taken away. Now the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit is of the Lord, there is freedom. And we who with unveiled faces all reflect the Lord's glory are being transformed into his likeness with everlasting glory, which comes from the Lord who is in the Spirit." And isn't that really the purpose of the creation? I mean, what did God say at the beginning? "Let us make man in our image and after our likeness." And certainly, being face to face is how that happens. We see it happen with parents and children, even from the day that they're born. You know, they are focused on the face. And we certainly want to be in face to face with God. We want that expression to occur. We want to be able to mirror that, what we see in his face. And that's what the prophets and what David saw. They saw that ministry as it was expressed face to face. And certainly that's something that, you know, with our relationship with God, that likeness of our Father, then can be expressed to other people. And that's certainly part of God's ministry, just expressed through us. This PBS special, like I said, there was an awful lot in there in just a few minutes. You know, how we read others, how we offer ourselves to others, how someone that's blinded can't see. You know, when you think about the people that had been treated with Botox, how conversion takes place, you know, how our eyes are opened, how we can have an effect on the world around us, how God can have a transformative effect on us, how our light shines, how the love of Jesus shines through us. I mean, there's all kinds of things that we think about that we read, particularly in the New Testament, that gains a little bit deeper understanding when we see how God created us and how those things occur even subtly in just the expressions that come out on our face. So I just found this really fascinating. I thought it was something that I wanted to kind of pass on to everybody because it gives us a little bit more of an insight not only as to how the patriarchs and why they said certain things that they did and why it was so important, but why it's very important for us. It's important for us not only for our spiritual health, but it's also very important for us in terms of how we express God's love to others. Any thoughts or comments? Cindy? Yes. David Eagleman is the presenter's name. He's a neuroscientist from Baylor University, and he teaches in their College of Medicine. This is episode 5 of the series called The Brain on PBS, and you can find it online. And like most PBS specials, you can buy it if you want to buy the DVD set or that kind of thing. Bill?
You know, it's just like I have toy poodles, and that not only can tell your mood or facial expressions, they won't wag their tail till you smile. But if you got a gloomy face, you know, but they will wag their tail when you smile, so they can pick up on your facial expressions too.
I took the Dale Carnegie course and actually quite a few speaking courses, but it is amazing. Science has known a long time that like 70 or 80% of communication is nonverbal. So our countenance, not only looks, but our voice, anger in our voice or gentleness in our voice, it's all picked up by other people. I never understood exactly how that happened, but it's pretty easy to recognize and relate to the idea that nonverbal communication is way more important than the words you say.
Back at the winter weekend down in Lexington, Hal Geiger gave a seminar over Aaron's blessing in Numbers 6 on the people. And his seminar was on the fact that the Hebrew or the English language doesn't capture all the word pictures that the Hebrew language does. So he's going through that. And in verse 26, the Lord lift up his countenance upon thee and give thee peace. He spent quite a few minutes on that, the fact that God lifts his countenance up. And how or why would he do that? Dylan, can I borrow you for a second? Will you come here? So a lot of times when we're dealing with our kids, we look down and say, Dylan, that was a good job. But when we really want to get something across, we get down in front of them and we lift our countenance up to them. And that was just huge to realize that God does that to us on a regular basis, that he actually bows, gets down on his knee and lifts his countenance up to us so that we can see all of his facial features, in a sense.
Literally, face to face. Yeah. Amazing. Eileen.
I was just going to say that was a very nice find that you came upon. It was really just great. I don't know what to say. Just, I'm glad that you came upon it and shared it with us.
It was just fascinating to me when I saw it. And there's a lot more to this. And he spends a lot of time, in, as he said in the introduction, he even spends some time talking about how, you know, and obviously this is all in the context of the brain, not the face, but issues with hate and genocide and all kinds of things. And some of this is a little bit disturbing later in the episode, because you saw early on he was at a graveyard in he wasn't in France, he was in the Balkans, you know, where there was a lot of genocide that took place 20 years ago, and you know the things that went on there. Gary.
There we go. Having our background in worldwide or other churches that we may be in, we put the law so far up in our priority, not saying there's anything wrong with it, but it when it was magnified in the New Testament from kill to hate, or to from love, or from adultery to lust, that we got the jump then from, I guess what I'm trying to say is, under the old system, this is my experience, I was very judgmental of others if they didn't obey the law strictly. Under the new covenant understanding of the laws that are there, it's much more principle-oriented and attitude-oriented and desire to help and please and reflect God's love than it is to be, you broke it, you're dead.
Very good. Anybody else? Any other comments? All right, then we're done. Let's sing.